Pray with me for a moment. Father, I thank you for who you are, Lord. I thank you that you love mankind. I thank you for pouring your love upon us. I ask you, Lord, to bless each person here and supply them with what they need today. Bring encouragement, and I just ask you to take the things that we've presented to you, sung to you, offered to you, and all that we are here, Lord, and do your work with it, and bring glory to your name and blessing to us, and bring blessing to others through us because of your love and your faithfulness. And I ask you, Father, for your help now. And may your name be praised. In Yeshua's name, amen. So, that's interesting, you know, Ruthanna. What did you say? You read some things. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, right? So, kind of sounds like if you follow the Lord, then you won't be in the dark. Kinda, right? Or is that what it says? Yeah, I think maybe that's what it says. You concur, Dean? So, when things seem dark and confusing, sometimes it just might be which way you're walking. If you're following the Lord, darkness isn't what he's going to give you. Judy, Yeshua was the only really true, perfect and fitting sacrifice, wasn't he? So everything's different because of him. I'm different. You're different. Everything's different because of him. So, and then, Craig, you know, I don't know if I remembered you were never planning on going to college, but, you know, I was planning on never going. And were you planning on never going? Or you just didn't plan to go?
I didn't see the necessity.
Yeah, I knew I wasn't going. I planned on not going. It's a little bit similar. Anyway, I'm trying to remember some of the things that you said. But did you say Jacob tricked Esau into giving him the birthright?
I did, but I don't think that I actually meant to say that, or I might have taken that back and just said that he received it from him.
Okay. Does anybody think Jacob tricked Esau into giving him the birthright?
He was manipulative.
What?
I think he was manipulative. Saw the opportunity.
Well, I mean, Jacob may have been manipulative. But really, I mean, how crafty and invisible was this great deception that he cast upon Esau? What? Right, there was no deception whatsoever. It's like I come in and I'm all tired, and you know, you have a sandwich. And I say, oh, please, you know, give me that sandwich. And you say, well, give me your life savings, your firstborn, and all of your flocks, and you can have the sandwich. I go, okay. It's like, I've been duped, tricked, you know, had the wool pulled over my eyes. No, I'm just, I don't care. I'm just wantonly unconcerned about things that really matter. And that was how Esau acted in that moment. It says that Jacob says what he says, does what he does. Esau says what he says and does what he does. But the Torah says Esau despised his birthright. It's not Esau's review. It's not even Jacob's review. It's the Torah's review of Esau. He despised his birthright. So, you know, to despise it, you know, you could imagine that if he really was going to die, or if a gun was held to his head, or a sword was at his throat, and, you know, they're going to draw and quarter him, you know, maybe he'd give it up. But he gave it up for nothing, except a moment of impulse and a bowl of red stuff. Depending on the translation, you know, one says broth, one says this, one says that, but it wasn't much. It was nothing. He didn't care. He wasn't concerned about it. And it, mostly, not to Jacob's credit, Esau wasn't concerned with the things of God, really at all. Jacob was. It's not necessarily obvious. Jacob was after something. He was always after something. He thought that he could get it using his own devices. But there was something in Esau that wasn't driven towards what God had promised. And in fact, the promise wasn't to Esau. And I, for a long time, have been deeply sympathetic to Esau when he cries out about the blessing. I don't know if it's just because I grew up hunting and wanted to be. I mean, there was a time in my life where, as far as the easiest, most immediate, most humanly compelling thing there was, it was hunting. I wouldn't have traded it for my relationship with God, but it was something that could compete in my affections. And so where do we go from here? Not everything that's said about Esau is exactly about Esau, the individual, in the scriptures. You know, Esau was given an inheritance. His descendants were given an inheritance. God protected it. God even told Israel, don't you even think about trying to take one square inch of it. It's not like God had no concern and didn't care at all. And I'm not exactly sure what I think of Esau, the individual, and his overall destiny. I know Christian tradition and Jewish tradition say a whole bunch of things about it. Mostly unkind. The Torah isn't quite as black and white as the traditions are. Doesn't paint Esau as a wantonly and only evil person. But doesn't really hold him up as an example of righteousness or anything like that either. But, you know, he does weep on his brother's neck on his return. And he seems to come to terms with his lot. But I was going to ask you about Isaac. What do you think about Isaac? If I asked you what's the most notable thing to you about Isaac, what would you say? What? I didn't hear the answer, but if you weren't talking about Isaac, it doesn't matter. When you think about Isaac, I mean, what matters most about him? What's the most notable thing about him? What can you say about him?
He
You've been reading the Talmud. What?
He didn't seem to struggle when his dad was about to sacrifice
him. It certainly doesn't tell us that he struggled. There are many commentators speculate that his family problems were from that traumatic event, and that he was forever psychologically marred by what happened on that mountain. But the Bible doesn't say that. But I'd like to know exactly what he was thinking myself, but the scriptures don't tell me. Yeah, go ahead.
There's a lot of things for you that seem not that great about that.
This is true.
But then I also look at the fact that he did stay in the way. That's one thing.
Yeah. Jacob. So, well, you both got what I think. I mean, he was the son of the promise. That's a big deal. You know, it really doesn't matter what he did, because he was the son of the promise. I mean, I don't mean it doesn't matter anything. Nothing he did matters. I mean, he was the son of the promise, was the son of the promise, was the son of the promise, period. He didn't choose to be. He couldn't change it. He doesn't get credit for being that son. But that is very notable about him. But when you look at all the patriarchs, it really stands out that Isaac lived his entire life inside of the land. He never went outside of it, ever. And so, is that a big deal? Well, yeah, probably. And Isaac probably gets more credit than sometimes people give him when they just look at what it looks like his family was like and what he did. But in the beginning of chapter 26 of Genesis, it says, "Now there was a famine in the land besides the former famine that was in the days of Abraham. And Isaac went to Gerar, to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. And the Lord appeared to him and said, 'Do not go down to Egypt.'" Now you remember previously Abraham was very clear with his servant when going looking for a wife. No matter what happens, under no circumstances, do not ever take my son back there. It was not going to happen. Abraham seems to have understood that Isaac should never ever cross outside of the borders of the land that didn't in essence exist yet. It existed in terms of God's promise. Abraham knew what it would be someday. But it didn't exist in the sense that it was not a country that was held by that people yet. But Isaac is supposed to stay there. And so this famine comes up. God tells him not to go to Egypt. He says, "Dwell in the land of which I shall tell you. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and will bless you. For to you and to your offspring I will give all these lands, and I will establish the oath that I swore to Abraham your father." Now, do you think that establishing this and what it all depends on has something to do with him staying in the land and never going out of it? You bet it does. And the famine, well, from what I can tell, famines are a pretty big deal. Why? Because people starve to death during famines. Abraham went to Egypt to be saved from a famine. Israel ended up in Egypt. In one sense, in order to be saved from famine. And here we are with Isaac. It's obvious to go to Egypt when there's a famine, because I guess there's always food in Egypt. Yeah, there's water. So, "I will multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven, and will give to your offspring all these lands, and in your offspring all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge and my commandments, my statutes and my laws." So, you know, Abraham, God calls Abraham, he goes out, not knowing where he's going, leaves his land, his people, his family, goes to a place that God's going to tell him, and he does what God asks him to do. And at the moment of the death of his wife, not the moment, but at that time, he goes to get a burial place. And I don't remember who all discussed this. We talked about it a little last week at my house. But, you know, Abraham actually purchases a piece of what God promised him to bury his wife in. And two rich men go back and forth, and it's kind of a formula. It's not exactly really a casual conversation. It follows a formula of the way things were done in that part of the world in ancient times. And in some places, things are still done very much like that. So he buys the cave in the field for roughly the equivalent of 60 years pay for the average working man at the time. Now, if you imagine one working man wanting to own one little field, Abraham paid perhaps more than a lot of working men made during their life, because I'm pretty sure quite a few of them didn't live to be 60. So he paid a lot of money. So when it is finally said to Abraham, oh, what's a piece of land that's worth 60 years pay for one of these schleps over here between you and me? We're so rich, it doesn't matter if I, you know, extremely overcharge you, because you're never going to miss it anyway. And what Abraham does is he just goes, okay, and he just weighs it right out, because he's not caring about how much it cost him. I actually think he had more than just a burial place in mind. But once again, Abraham acts in a way where nobody can say to him either that they made him rich, or that, well, we gave you that property when you were in your time of need. We're so great. We met your need. Nobody can say that, because he paid way too much for it, and he didn't care. He left it in God's hands, which is what he normally did. And even sleeping with Hagar to get a son, he didn't do it against God's promise. God almost seems sneaky in not letting him know to begin with. By the way, it's going to be a son born through Sarah. So if somebody comes up with the idea, use a surrogate, it's not going to work, because that's not going to be the one that I choose. I think God wanted, well, I'm not, let's, we'll just leave that alone for now. Or maybe indefinitely. So here we are. Abraham drives a stake in the ground, in the fabric of time, by buying that piece of property. It's too much as usual. But I was thinking back to Noah, and, you know, Noah is called the preacher of righteousness. I don't know of anyone ever listening to him. The scriptures don't say that he interceded on behalf of the ancient world, but we might be able to surmise in some way that preaching to them was something that could be counted that way. But when it comes to him and his family being saved, what intervenes between him and the death that the whole world experiences is the hull of the ark, and the fact that God chose him. But when God comes to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, Abraham stands between God and his wrath and Sodom and Gomorrah and says, hey, what if there's somebody righteous? Hey, you're not going to just wipe people out without a thought. You're not going to be unjust, are you? And he states quite accurately, whoa, I'm nothing but dust and ashes, but you made me in your image, so what about it? You're not going to wipe them out, are you? And Abraham actually cared. It mattered to him that people were going to be destroyed because of the wickedness of Sodom. But he wasn't going to go so far as to say, well, God, if there's nobody righteous, or there's not even 10, and you've made a judgment, I'm going to tell you that you're wrong and you should just turn a blind eye. But it matters to him. And so what we see is the beginning of what Israel is meant to be in the world, which is something, Israel is called to be a light to the nations. And Abraham is the first evidence of that happening. And then it's a big deal that Isaac just stayed where he was supposed to be. It's faithfulness. And the one verse, it's interesting because in the English translations, it just basically says Isaac stayed there and grew great and, you know, got rich. Let's see, it's I should have it right in front of me here. Genesis 26:13. What does it say in, let's see, the ESV says, and the man became rich and gained more and more until he became very wealthy. Yep, yeah. Can you tell me what the Hebrew says, Noah? You got it in front of you? What? What? Enlarge? In verse 13? Okay, so this is from, I guess it has to do with the forms and roots and things, which I'm no expert on, but this is one translation, and the man grew great and he walked to walk and grew until very great. And this is Jonathan Allen's comment on it. The word which he's referring to here is used three times in a verse, twice as a verb and once as a noun. The root meaning is to be or become great or to grow. And we find the word used of children growing up and also as part of the title of high priest. But in between, let me make sure I'm reading the right thing here. It's probably more than I can handle without looking into more things, but he says this is supported by the dictionaries. It is interesting to take the alternative, more literal translation and notice that the Torah is telling us that in the midst of growing wealth, Yitzhak walked the walk. In other words, in spite of his increasing substance, wealth, responsibility, he was faithful to God and wasn't drawn away by his wealth, which happened to so many. Anyway, I'll leave that behind. I was thinking about, so the firstborn is always supposed to get the greater share, right? I don't know where Abraham stood in his family, but in pure technical terms, Isaac is not the firstborn to Abraham. And Jacob is not Isaac's firstborn. And when it comes to Jacob and his sons, is it the firstborn that ends up preeminent? No. And when it comes to Israel having a king, is it the firstborn from the family? No, it's the last son. The one that nobody, they weren't even going to run him out in front of Samuel as an example. He was so far down the line. So how often does the firstborn in God's economy for his whole plan of world redemption seem to get chosen? How many can you show me? Well, Yeshua is the firstborn. Kind of interesting. In God's planning of so many things, he turns... Well, I mean, the fact is that the place of the firstborn is actually also instituted by God in most cases. It's not that God cares not about the firstborn. In fact, he's so concerned about it that if a man has two wives and the one that he doesn't really love so much has his first son, he can't give the birthright or what the firstborn is meant to have to the firstborn from the wife that he really does love, because that's not actually his firstborn. So God cares about that, but when God is setting up his own plan for what he's going to do in the world, he chooses the person that's not first in line. But Yeshua certainly was the firstborn. So he does choose the firstborn when it comes to the Messiah. There's something in Jacob that has to have what's been promised to him. He goes about it almost entirely in the wrong way, maybe entirely in the wrong way. A lot of the time, for a long time. And he learns as he goes, but it takes a lot for him to learn his lesson. And it seems like, even to the very end, some things aren't entirely resolved in his heart about what he's supposed to be and what he should have had and how he wanted things. But by the time he comes to the end of his life, he does see clearly, by the time his eyes aren't so clear, more what God decided to do and how he's working than he did to begin with. And by the time that he once again blesses the wrong son of Joseph's, from Joseph's perspective, no, not so, Father. He sees so clearly when he's blind that he crosses his arms and puts his right hand on the head of the wrong one, but it's not the wrong one. It's just not the way it would have been by normal reckoning. And it wasn't what Joseph wanted. So much of what happens down through the whole story of this family that becomes the nation of Israel doesn't seem to be what the individuals wanted exactly. And I can only speculate, well, I'm sure God was in charge, so I don't think Rebecca had to put Jacob up to the deception for God's will to be done. I don't think Jacob had to try to get the birthright from Esau for things to go the right way. I don't think they had to lie and deceive. But Isaac appears to be not grasping what God has said, but he has to know. And I don't know, maybe he was too soft. Maybe he did just favor Esau so much that somehow he would have done the wrong thing and something had to intervene. I don't know, it's hard to explain some of it. But So Isaac stays where God tells him to stay. And he doesn't go to be sustained by Egypt, even though it would appear that if God had not intervened, that he probably would have, which is why God comes and tells him in no uncertain terms not to go down to Egypt. And sometimes, you know, just staying put is a really big deal. Really big. In fact, I think a lot of the time, just staying put is a really big deal. Except when, like Abraham, God says, go. Well, if he would have stayed put, well, that would have been a big deal. But then Abraham wouldn't have been Abraham. Going when you're supposed to go and staying put when you're supposed to stay put is a big deal. It kind of almost seems to me that everything that matters in life in some way is tied to staying put if you're supposed to stay put and moving if you're supposed to move. And you don't have to make it all happen in order to do either one. God makes his will come about one way or another, and his will in our lives comes about and becomes clear, much more clear, much sooner, if we stay put when we should stay put and if we move when he says to move. But it does seem like our natural inclination is to move when he says to stay put and to stay put when he says to move. It's actually what it seems to me in my own life is what I felt like an awful lot of the time. Anybody else notice something like this? So today I just want to make sure to give Isaac a huge amount of credit for just staying put. And I don't think that's all that he did. I think he did more than that. But we don't have a huge amount of detail, but we do know that he stayed there. And so his staying there it's a huge thing that's just stitched into the fabric of time, can never be moved. And it's the real beginning of the coming about of everything that God promised all the way to the end. Everything that Abraham saw. When it says of Abraham, Yeshua says, Abraham saw my day and rejoiced. I believe that Isaac's faithfulness simply in staying where God told him to stay is an enormous event in the history of God's plan of redemption. And this is the son of the promise living out his entire life inside of the borders of the land that is promised without actually owning it, but never seeking sustenance outside of the borders of God's will for him, which was to stay in that land no matter what, because God told him and he listened. And that is a big deal. And I think it's something that we can apply in all sorts of situations in our own life. And I'm just going to read you this from Hebrews 12, and then I'm going to stop. It says this here in the 12th chapter of Hebrews, starting at the 14th verse, "Strive for peace with everyone and for the holiness without which no one will see the Lord. See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble, and by it many become defiled, that no one is sexually immoral or unholy, like Esau, who sold his birthright for a single meal. I thought of this when, I was thinking about it before, but when Ruthanna was talking, and she said, let's see, what was it she said? Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, right? And in Hebrews 12 here in the 14th verse, strive for peace with everyone and for the holiness without which no one will see the Lord. If you follow the Lord, you won't be in darkness. You can see when you're not in the darkness. And the way that you see is by following the Lord. If you follow the Lord, you'll have light to see by. And the holiness without which no one will see the Lord, I don't think it's, you know, I thought of it this time around in a way that didn't only seem to be about finally the end result, but pursuing God, following Him, and obeying Him is the place in which you see the Lord. Are you following me? Am I making sense? It's not make yourself holy and then you'll see God. It's just open your eyes and see God when He shows up. Follow Him and you'll see. You won't be in the darkness if you follow Him. And so you will see the Lord and the holiness we're supposed to pursue is tied up really in not trying to be holy, just listening, following, finding ourselves in the light because we're following the one who is the light. And then, you know, you can see the Lord if you're following Him. It's much harder to see Him when you're walking the other way, hoping that He'll show up in the midst of your own will. It never works. Anyway, weave whatever you heard into something that God's trying to tell you. Take the pieces that matter from what everybody said and just listen to whatever God is speaking to you today. Did somebody say something? Oh, Lord, I thank You for everyone here. I ask You just to meet us all where we are and what we're going through. And You don't have to prove Yourself, but You always prove Yourself faithful. I ask that we would grasp that, take a hold of it. Pour Your blessings on everyone here. In Yeshua's name, amen. Bishamru.